Of these three cardinal features of Renaissance educational theory, the most distinctive, universal, and essential was its emphasis on humanism, or stress on classical literature. As well known, they made the classics the core of the curriculum in general education. The second major feature, as is also well known, was its ideal of the homo universalis, and its consequent broad program designed to produce a well-rounded man. The final salient feature of Renaissance educational theory, and we may add practice, was its definite inclusion of Christian religion and morality. While it may be true that some of humanists were skeptical, it was certainly not the case with most of them, and the present writer knows of no educational theorist in the era of whom it may be affirmed. Because the writings of Renaissance theorists are replete with classical allusions and quotations, and because their views frequently correspond to those of the ancient authors, it has often been assumed that Renaissance educational speculation was primarily a resuscitation of the ancient classical, divorced from any major dependence on the medieval. Yet the conclusion by no means necessarily follows from the premises. Medieval writers also habitually invoked classical authority, and medieval pedagogy likewise agreed in many of its major lineaments, as well as on lesser points of the ancients from which it directly descended. I don't go into any detail on the Renaissance theory because I'm sure you're all familiar with it. The quotation of ancient classical writers by Renaissance theorists is frequently in the nature of a corroboration for views whose fundamental reasons are more organic. It was fashionable, almost imperative, even as it had been in varying degrees throughout the Middle Ages, to employ extracts from the classics to confirm and adorn one's statements and arguments. It cannot be denied that ancient classical treatises had an important influence on the development of Renaissance educational theory. Such an influence, however, was not peculiar to Renaissance speculation as distinguished from that of the Middle Ages. Much of it came through the latter, in which it was already deeply embedded. There was a special affinity between Renaissance and ancient writers on pedagogy, inasmuch as these had primarily in view the education of the laity. It was not necessary to make quite as many adjustments as had been the case with medieval theorists whose pedagogy was deeply classical. That is the fundamental consideration. Renaissance theory was for laymen. Most of the medieval had been for clerics, and therein lies the difference. During the Middle Ages, down to the 13th century, a number of treatises dealing primarily with the education of clerics were composed. Representative of such were works by Cassiodorus, Isidore of Seville, Rabanus Maus, Theory of God, Hugh of St. Victor, Conrad of Hirschau, and John of Salisbury, all prior to the 13th century. Now, Isidore wasn't exactly an educational theory, although it was for the education part and had a number of implications. But the others were works designed to discuss and delineate the way that education part could proceed. The 12th century was a golden era of medieval pedagogical speculation. In the course of that century, four important treatises on educational theory were composed, two by a Frenchman, one by a German, one by an Englishman. They were given Greek titles because of the increasing contemporary interest in Greek, although often these titles were rather strange, part of various elements of the curriculum as the Middle Ages progressed. Thus, technical grammar was stressed in so-called Carolingian Renaissance, classical literature in the first half of the 12th century Renaissance, logic in the later part of that period, and philosophy in general in the 13th century. This is all connected with widening horizons, horizons, virtues, and so on. What is really deserving of remark is not that medieval theory of education designed primarily for clerics accorded a supreme position to religious studies, but that it was as liberal as it was. This fact is attested by numerous evidences and sources, including the support of pedagogical treatises. Liberal learning remained in high esteem throughout the period, and continued to be cultivated by clerics. Its literary, scientific, and philosophical content was progressively expanded. In the 12th century, clerical humanism became so strong that some historians have seen fit to characterize the era as the Renaissance. John of Salisbury, writing in Defense of Logic in 1159, could not resist the temptation to extend his treatise to include grammar, with due stress on the reading of the authors, to which subject he devotes a full quarter of his work, which is entitled In Defense of Logic. Of course, the only thing about it is broadcast. Despite the perseverance and revival of considerable lay literacy during the previous Middle Ages, the first known medieval treatises concerning general education designed expressly for the laity were written by Vincent of Beauvais and Egidio Colonna of Giles of Rome in the 13th century. Vincent's treatise, composed during the sunset of Elijah's scholarly labors, was entitled On the Education of Noble Children. That of Egidio, famous for his doctrine of consists of 20 chapters on the education of royal, aristocratic, and upper bourgeois children in his work on the governance of rulers. Both authors were religious, one a Dominican, the other an Augustinian. Both were highly distinguished and respected, and both had practical experience in type education as a study. Now, this is the transitional to the medieval or the Renaissance educational theory. The program outlined by Vincent and Egidio for the general education of lay leaders is broad and generous. It includes the traditional liberal arts of grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. The cultivation of literary taste is expressly urged. Grammar and reading will, of course, continue to include poetry, drama, and history. The natural sciences, together with political science and economics, are to be taught, as well as metaphysics and ethics. Even instruction preparatory to the United States is included. Religion is an important part of education, moral training is recognized fundamental. To be included, our social adaptation, inculcation of good manners, and physical as well as military training. Also discussed in this discussion in the Renaissance is the education of girls. It can be readily seen that the education of girls is in the video of transitional. As been remarked, the most fundamental feature of Renaissance educational theory was its humanism, that the principle of the extensive study of classical Latin and literature together with the development of the literary style was firmly rooted in medieval pedagogical tradition. It is true that the intensity of Renaissance enthusiasm for such a constantly dominant place for literary studies and curriculum may have been new in its day. It is also true that Renaissance and they have had a keen appreciation of nature in itself and man's life in this world. But these features can largely be accounted for by the fact that Renaissance culture was more lay than clerical. Throughout the medieval period, Latin grammar was always recognized as a gateway to and foundation for all learning. And its study definitely included the reading of representative and literary masterpieces. continued the ancient practice of drawing up lists of recommended authors whose works were considered basic in the light of classics, or esteemed classics. And there are many lists of these, of course. In the 13th century, German draws up a list of 80 of these. Georg Simber, which seems to be about the attitude of these days. The Middle Ages also put considerable stock in the payment of rebel facility in Latin, which accomplishment is known as eloquentia, highly recommended by and praised by John Salisbury. Although rhetoric no longer retained the bargaining tradition generally to be formerly enjoyed, its principal forms and themes were studied and employed and even given new applications. Although eloquence continued to be a style and cultural ideal in the Middle Ages, as in antiquity it was strongly counterbalanced and moderated by other ideals, such as those of truth and rationality, faith and morality. It also designated a universal facility posture of war, whose ambit embraced all forms of verbal expression and included poetry as well as prose. During the 12th century, medieval philological and literary studies first reached their apogee and then were unseated from their position of presence among the liberal arts. Study philosophy was on the increase, something kind of good, and what gave was the study of the authors. However, philological and literary studies were by no means totally flipped. For instance, John Darwin, Jules Strindberg, in Germany, for instance, where they didn't have universities as yet, and many places in Italy and elsewhere, it seems to continue without much change. And in Italy, and in general, of course, the partial lapse was only temporary, and the fluctuating balance was more than restored by the Renaissance humanists. The paper goes on to discuss the woman universality idea in the medieval period. It has been maintained by some even that Renaissance pedagogy was simply the result of grasping earlier medieval monastic academic education on the chivalrous training of the High Middle Ages. That's an interesting hypothesis, and it's actually somewhat the general idea behind the certain modern paper. While there is some argument for this position, it seems extreme. At the same time, it is indubitable that the two main elements of the broad Renaissance program, the intellectual academic on the one side and the physical and social on the other, had already been involved in previous medieval academic and chivalrous education. On the intellectual or academic side, most of the subjects of the Renaissance program were included in the medieval study of the liberal arts and cultivation of philosophy. The blossoming of philosophy in the High Middle Ages further helped to stimulate the development and cultivation of the natural and social sciences, since they were, of course, included in philosophy. But what a physical and social change. Formal education, medieval era, consists principally of two types of practical and chivalry. In the education part, the inculcation of social virtues and adaptation to community living was considered indispensable. Moreover, players were being trained to perform a definite function in society, which is social education. Although not of course, the broader exactly true to those things that they should lay life. The latter type of training was to be found in chivalrous education. And of course, we're all familiar with that. It is to be observed, interestingly, that most Renaissance treatises on pedagogy directly concerned were addressed to members of the lay aristocracy. Regarding the final turning feature of Renaissance education, there is Christian religious and moral aspects that can be no doubt addressed. advance the medieval educational building practice, coupled with existing conditions and needs, provided the sufficient background for the Renaissance pedagogical program. I ought to start with a word of explanation. If you detect that you find a retrospective quality in certain parts of this patient, the reason is that in reality it forms the conclusion of a study on Mozart and the Greek epic. I had nothing to say for this occasion, and Professor Carl Meyer graciously gave me permission to read from this study. In an article which revealed an admirable grasp of the field of French literature in the 16th century and of the relationship of that literature to its classical quotient, Professor James Hutton of Cornell University made the following illuminating observation. The Renaissance represents the historical moment when European thought was ready to come to terms with the whole of its ancient heritage, and not merely with some part of it. One of the more remarkable illustrations of this process was the literary activity of Ronsard and his colleagues. What is absolutely certain, says Robert Hyatt, is that Ronsard was the founder of elevated lyric poetry and classical models, not only for France, but for all modern Europe. Taken together, these two statements constitute the dynamic premises of the present remark, for it cannot be a matter of indifference whether a poet to whom the Western world is so greatly indebted was able to come to terms with our ancient heritage in the most direct and rewarding manner through a knowledge of some of the fundamental literary texts of antiquity in the language in which they were written. In antiquity, the poet and Homer especially were honored as possessing an almost encyclopedic understanding of things terrestrial, infernal, and celestial. In spite of the severe reservations that Plato frequently expresses about the religious and social aspects of poetry, Homer must have represented for him the summation of some of the highest values of Greek civilization. Otherwise, Socrates could hardly have been made to stay in the Republic, as he was about to attack the basis of Homer's art. I have always, from my earliest youth, had an awe and love of Homer, which even now makes the word falter. Yes, of course. Yes. The front and where to begin with. Otherwise, Socrates could hardly have been made to stay in the Republic, as he was about to attack the basis of Homer's art. I have always, from my earliest youth, had an awe and love of Homer, which even now makes the word falter on my lips. There is perhaps a good deal of conviction mingled with the irony in the following conversation between Socrates and the rhapsode Ion. Socrates, does not Homer speak of the same things which all other poets handle? Is not war his great argument? And does he not speak of human society and of intercourse of men, good and bad, skilled and unskilled, and of the gods conversing with one another and with mankind?
And about what happens in heaven and in the world below, and the generations of gods and heroes, are not these the themes of the only things? Very true, Socrates. And do not the other poets sing the same? Yes, Socrates, but not in the same way at home. What? In a worse way? Yes, in a far worse. And Homer in a better way? He is incomparably better. The earliest mention of Homer among Greek writers is that of Xenophanes, who described him as the teacher of Greek. From the beginning, all have learned from him, said Xenophanes. This opinion must have been widely held in Greece for Socrates to be able to say, then Glaucon, whenever you meet with eulogists of Homer who tell you that he has educated Greece, it will be your duty to greet them affectionately as excellent men and to admit that Homer is first and greatest among tragic poets. But Homer was more than a teacher and more than a poet. He was the poet. In every period of Greek literature, and indeed of Greek art, Homer is the outstanding criterion of all that is aesthetically matched. And this tribute is paid to him even by those who, like Hesiod, Pythagoras, Heraclitus, and Xenophanes and Plato themselves, raise serious objections of an ethical and religious nature to certain aspects of the Homeric epos. But Odysseus hath one thing far beyond all his sufferings, says Pindar, thanks to the sweet lays of Homer. For on Homer's fiction and on his winged skill there resteth a solemn spell. And the greatest of the lyric poets pays this further tribute to the first of the epic poets, when he says that Ajax in death is honored throughout all the world by Homer. For whatsoever one hath well said, goeth forth with a voice that never dies, and thus over the fruitful earth and sea hath passed the light of noble deeds, unquenchable forever. In these words, Pindar strikes the note that will continue to sound in all the literature of the Occidental world. He states the principle of Homer's greatness, the beautiful expression of noble deeds. The notion of a possible divorce between the ethical and aesthetic realms is foreign to the thinking of Pindar, as it was to that of Homer and to the Greeks generally. The inexhaustible vitality of Homer results from the union of these truths, the ethical and aesthetic, at the level of the highest intensity of each. Ronsard's epic, the Panthéon, was the most sustained poetic effort and the most grievous disappointment of Ronsard's career. Nevertheless, it would be a mistake, I think, to see in the relative failure of his poem more than an incident of minor importance against the background of his achievement in introducing the Greek epic into French literature and thought. Ronsard enters upon the scene in the dawn of Homeric influence created by the timid efforts of Jean Lemaître, for whom Dipsis and Dares were the authentic voices, by the circumscribed knowledge of Clément Marot, aware of little besides the legends of Helen of Troy and of Odysseus, brightened somewhat by the superior but still sporadic information of Rabelais, and by the partial translations of Salel and Tolkien. But the scene is entirely transformed within a few years of Ronsard's appearance, and by the time he prepares to say, farewell, pleasant sunlight, and we must abandon homes and orchards and gardens. In Homeric, the Hellenic sun is shining in broad day upon the gardens cultivated by the poets of Vendôme and Turenne. To be sure, he was not alone. His generation was distinguished by a score of poets and writers, many of whom shared his admiration for Greece and contributed greatly to the renewal and transmission of her literary traditions. Like his colleagues of the Pléiad, he owed a great debt to their guide, Jean Jaurès, who pointed out the difficult road to them and was able to reveal some of the intellectual and spiritual riches that awaited them if they persevered. But the guide could not, even if he would, take from his disciples the toil of that road. It is clear that it was in the nature of the reward that caused Ronsard to find delight in the toil itself. After some years, he was able to discover his own way, perhaps even with a taste purer than his master's. He soon was able to study Homer and the other Greek poets independently, and even to excel the official translators, both in poetic insight and literal fidelity. In the end, once the reality of the fact has been established, the poet's capacity for literal fidelity to a great text would matter least, or not at all, if it were not sometimes the ground of deep poetic insight. The imaginative transformations that occur in Ronsard are based upon that exact understanding of the text which admitted him to the living thought of Homer. From this encounter, with which the name of Virgil, one of the greatest of the Homerides, was indissolubly associated, Ronsard brought back a criterion of excellence whose influence in his own work was constant and not limited to the epic composition. His manner of presenting and extolling this criterion is often banal or beautifully programmatic, but there are moments when it becomes a vision of perfection in which exaltation and despair struggle for the possession of Ronsard's mind. The vision and the struggle could never have been absent from his thought once the frontyard had begun to assume form, even as an outline. They are already explicit in the dialogue of the Muses and Ronsard. They are revived at the end of the last preface to his epic in the verses that begin, Homer renowned in knowledge and in name, and are there consummated and resolved in humility. Upon thy knees, Pontius, worship the Aeneid, adore the Aeneid. As one considers Ronsard's achievement, one is astonished at the magnitude of his Hellenic legacy. He gave to France, at an important turning point in her literary history, the example of a poet who was by profoundest information a human. It was an example of immediate and lasting efficacy. The whole generation of his coevals, not to mention his successors, issued directly from him, as he affirmed with a proud assurance that history has ratified. It is not sensible to say that the quickening power of his influence reached backward into time, for the literary standards that he set reversed the styles of poets older than he. Perhaps the greatest tribute paid to Ronsard by his contemporaries is not to be thought in the terms of his fame, but in the fact that even his adversaries could attack him only with the arms that he had created, arms beaten out often enough upon an epic. Gothic angle. Guy Bartas and Daubigny revered Ronsard in their epic writings, for in spite of the grotesque excesses of style of the first and the exaggerated though sincere passion of the second, the fundamental movement of their verse took its step from that of Ronsard, and their music, whether melodious or harsh, was first heard in his pages. The cry, thrice repeated, "They have lied, Gerard," by which Ronsard asserts his absolute superiority over Guy Bartas, is less the expression of a private literary egotism than the noble assertion of a magnanimous mind. The value of Ronsard's example lay in the fact that he showed the way back to the living source of much that is greatest in Occidental literature. It has been truly said that one may glean from the despised Francais a heap of passages that would make the glory of many a poet. The seed for that heap was largely gathered from the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Homeric hymns, from the Argonautica of Apollonius of Rhodes, the Theogony, and the works and days of Cicero, either directly or in the writings of the epic posterity of Greece. But this theme could not be parsimoniously reserved for flowing in the epic field. It fell in every corner of Ronsard's enameled garden and sprang into lovely flower among the odes, the elegies, the hymns, the sonnets. The sonnet to Marie de Fleur, "Comme on voit sur la branche au mois de mai la rose," to my mind is greatest, is grown from Homeric grain, for I am more than half persuaded that if one were to study the famous sonnet to Hélène de Cuvier, "When you shall have grown quite old in the evening by the light of the candle, seated at the hearth and unwinding the skein and spinning, you will say, as you sing my verses in wonderment, 'Ronsard celebrated me in the time when my beauty yet lived.' Then, no servant of your house that she hears this tidings, though half drowsing at her task, but will start from her slumber at the sound of Ronsard's name, resting thy name of immortal renown." If one were to study this sonnet, one would be tempted to find the stem upon which it grew in the fourth book of the Odyssey. "From her fragrant high youth chamber came forth Helen, and the handmaid Philo brought a silver basket filled with finely spun yarn, and across it was laid the distaff laden with violet dark wool. So Helen sat down upon the chair, and below was a footstool for the feet." The central action of this scene, the dramatist persona, and the gift of immortality, with the promise of fulfillment, are identical in Homer and in Ronsard. It is extraordinary, if one admits these parallels, that two of Ronsard's greatest sonnets should have been inspired by Homer. We may safely infer that the Hellenic anthology of epic verse that could be selected from the four books of the Pantheon would be a mere adumbration of the one that might be composed from the remaining thousands of pages of Ronsard's poetry. Such an anthology would be remarkable for its diversity of subjects, its poetic richness, its humanity, and its civilizing power. It would be supported and illuminated by a poetic theory, rather chaotic in organization, too rapidly formulated, but representing in vigorous and eloquent language a point of view that in its polemic orientation transforms French writing. The literature of France is still living within the momentum of this transformation. From the attunement of his ear and mind to the brazen instruments of the epic, Ronsard introduced into the poetry of his country tonalities that were a radical acoustic innovation. The signs of the Asiatic psychonomy in the ode to Michel de l'Hôpital must have fallen with shattering effect upon the unaccustomed senses of his readers, simultaneously dazzled by the vision of a world flaming and reeling beneath the lightning bolts of youth. Through the gates of Homer and Hesiod, Ronsard stepped far into a natural world which the blind poet taught him to see both in human terms and as aspects of the divine. The imagery of Homer enlarged his comprehension and his sympathy, revealed the affinities between the realms of nature and poetry, until he was able to see the destiny of a man written in a stricken flower, or the destiny of humanity in the falling leaf. He treated French thought with the names and histories and ethical ideals of the great epic heroes and heroines. He made France acquainted in a way that Homeric scholars could achieve only in a limited fashion with the religion of youth and of the epic period, with their terrible divinities of earth and lust and blood and vengeance, and their gracious and kindly divinities of forest and field and stream, and with the College of the Muses. From the pages of Homer, aided by his reading of the Old and New Testament, he forged the personal and liberating concept of a mighty universal and beneficent deity. When he laid down his pen, Ronsard had earned the Homeric title of a teacher of France. The drawing has been repeated, that science in the time of Galileo and Harvey suddenly came of age, dropping its milk teeth and other juvenilities, most of them the heritage of Aristotle. The measurements which Harvey performed, of which Galileo performed so painstakingly and interpreted so critically in the dialogues concerning the human sciences, and the arithmetical propositions which assisted William Harvey to prove that the blood moves in a circuit in the body, have been taken as the ushers of a bold new age of mathematical method and scientific achievement and integrity. I hope to do nothing to dim the effulgent reputations of these men. Whatever I shall say here about Harvey, I hope will carry with it high approval. But I should like to make clear that his advances have been of a different sort from those commonly suggested. He did prove the circuit of the blood, and he did establish certain important findings about animal generation, but this is not my interest here. Nor shall I take up questions of priority and originality. Pedro Pino, the elder Columbus and Servetus, evidently came within shouting distance of very important discoveries concerning the blood and vascular system. That is not particularly pertinent here, for although Harvey
with the careful student of his predecessors in anatomy, still as with Galileo, he was a synthesis in his work of value far beyond the sum of its parts or antecedents. What I find more interesting in itself and consequential for understanding science in the Renaissance and after is that Harvey's great demonstration is the result of a thorough application of certain principles, logical and metaphysical, that were by way of being forgotten by the anatomists, including the Aristotelians in Renaissance Italy. Paradoxically, these principles had found their completest and most subtle formulation in Aristotle himself. And though Harvey frequently says that Aristotle's physiology is wrong, nevertheless, I can accept the soul that the reason why the Englishman succeeded so brilliantly was that he represented preeminently the steady discipline of the Aristotelian analytic, metaphysics, and attendant physicism. Harvey's debts to Galen and to men of the Renaissance in matters of inspection were no doubt greater, yet the treasure he takes in Aristotle's methodology is incomparably more important to his inquiry and demonstration. Harvey's discovery of the circulating of the blood came as the climax to the revival of Greek learning which got underway in Italy in the 14th century and in England in the 15th. It was most of all the anatomical emphasis in Galen, which, after being developed by Vesalius, Columbus, and Fabricius, led to the framing of Harvey's question. Had the strongest influence in biology been from the Hippocratic school, or from Aristotle, or the Arab doctors, discovery of the true movement of the blood might have been postponed another 50 years when the compound microscope would make easier the inspection of capillaries. Such inspection would virtually force men to see their circulation without demanding the rigorous proof that Harvey gave, lacking as he did means to observe the transmission of blood from the arterial branches through the extremities and organs to the venous branches. He employed methods of reasoning to find systematic connections between the concepts he used, and he made good by a theoretic extrapolation the deficiencies of the mechanical means at his disposal for looking into the body and tracing the courses of small parts below the limit of ocular evidence. From his casual references, one may easily feel that his attitude toward Aristotle is at best ambivalent, and it must be from some of the more airy remarks of commentators that take in their cue, saying that he sought Aristotle's overthrow. I profess he begins both to learn as a teacher anatomy, not from books but from deceptions, not from the positions of philosophy but from the fabric of nature. Again, he called certain ideas of Aristotle erroneous and hasty conclusions. Like patterns of darkness, he goes on, they suddenly vanish before the light of anatomical inquiry. This is hardly the respectful treatment of a master by a devoted disciple. Yet Harvey also says, the authority of Aristotle has always such weight with me that I never think of differing from him inconsiderately. Much more significantly, Harvey's preface to his own treatise on animal generation is largely a paraphrase of sections of the posterior analytics and the physics of Aristotle. In addition, one finds the motion of the heart dotted with familiar peripatetic notions such as nature makes nothing in vain, the heart is the center of life, and so forth. The appeal to sense perception is final authority, moreover, is more assured and manifest than matters inferred by reason is part and parcel of the Aristotelian theory of science, where even mathematics is said to evolve by an intellectual process of extraction of quantities originally perceptible as the attributes of bodies. Where induction proceeds from singulars grasped first by the senses, and where absence of one kind of sense, vision, for example, is bound to result in corresponding deficiencies in scientific knowledge. Fabio echoes a variety of Aristotelian pronouncements in his own remarks on the growth of knowledge, although he says there is but one road to science, that to it in which we proceed from things more known to things less known, to matters more manifest, to matters more obscure, and universals are principally known to us, not springing by reasonings from universals particularly. Still, the comprehension of universals by the understanding is based on the perception of individual things for the senses. For Aristotle, sensation cannot judge the substance, the thought of the thing, but he limited the judging what a particular thing is impressed upon the sense organ. This limited kind of knowledge, if it be knowledge at all, is not real science. Demonstration develops the universal, sensation is of the particular. Since it is impossible to familiarize the pupil even with mathematics, by deductive syllogism alone or by solely grasping the universal, we must employ induction to lead up to the universal. Our mental processes start in individuals in order to give content to the subject of science. The content must begin with the essence of what is demonstrated. The statement of this essence is a definition which is intuitively grasped but is prepared for by induction. The motion of the heart has 18 short chapters. All in all, the treatise falls into 5 distinct parts. The first, the introductory matter, in which Harvey, after setting forth his purposes, shows the difficulties and inconsistencies in the views of his predecessors. Second, a short statement of the reasons for composing the text. Third, on the exact motions of the house and Harvey. The fourth, and perhaps most crucial and revolutionary, dealing with the motions of the blood, both in the lesser or pulmonary circulation and in the greater or systemic, and adding a summary. Finally, a series of a posteriori arguments concerning the principal ones about the circuit of the blood. Thus, the movement of Harvey's thought is not a simple Spencerian one, from inductions to deductions, or Euclidean, from axioms to theorems, nor is it quite the sort of four-step so-called scientific method made popular in our modern textbooks, the gathering of facts, the formulating of theories, the deducing of conclusions from the latter, and finally the confirming of the conclusions. Rather, Harvey implies a composite method, in which he is practically measuring the qualities against his own observations, dialectically weighing each with the other, going quite different ways, and at the same time laying down principles by which to demonstrate the natural motions and purposes of the arteries, heart, and blood. That's a series of technical procedures, dissecting, bloodletting, ligating, and so forth, and their results are never baldly reported, but are always presented in the light of the problem generated either by the conflict between the observed facts and received professional opinions, or between opinions and the necessary principles of physics, or principles inductively prepared for and intuitively grasped in Harvey's own anatomical and physiological science. I should like to consider three many lacking instances of Harvey's method. Three, the investigation of almost inexhaustible, strenuous complexity. The first example concerns the content of the blood vessel. Harvey suggests that the movement and structure of the heart differs from those of the lungs, and those of the arteries differ from those of the chest, different functions or tissues are likely. This is what Aristotle has called time, leading from things back to cause and some cause. It is appears furthermore that something is or may be connected with something else. Aristotle is careful to point out that in many cases this kind of syllogism is as valuable as one beginning to confess. Harvey now brings two objections against Galen's aspect view, noting that Galen says it's just contradictory, contrary to experience, contrary to reading, and contrary to experience. Objection 6 in the list runs, the pulsation's true legato, as Galen says, we may say that the authors themselves know he didn't have that, and not more clear. So other conclusions that God alone is to be found in authors, as indeed is interpreted in being all extent. The second example is to bring the so-called greater circulation, that is, the passage of blood through air from the left ventricle to the arteries to the body as a whole, and its final return by laying the veins to the heart again. Here, having made use of a famous series of arguments, some of them avowedly supplicated regarding quantities of fluid. Blood is forced, he says, by each beating of the heart out of the left ventricle. And in 30 minutes, the total amount of blood cells expelled would be far greater than that which could be changed by a metamorphosis of contained food into blood. This takes for granted a physical principle that a certain amount of material is not made to make lesser paper from that. Aristotle had taught that blood reaching the peripheral ends of the vessels from the heart is converted into hair, eyelashes, and so forth, while whatever did not reach the cutaneous layers is deposited as internal sweat. Harvey does not even bother with this, since his measure would show blood to move in large quantities in organisms having little or no new tissue. An opponent objecting that though the heart may beat and the cracks may be shut, nevertheless, no blood could be needed to tell the heart merely contracting about some spiritual substance. Is always answered by Harvey's remark that he has already proven that spirits separated from the blood itself have not moved when the heart is moved, and not moved when the blood is moved, would not be spirits at all. If the heart dwells in mere nothing but contraction, is against reason. In passing, Harvey notes that his quantitative results, he calculates about 500 ounces of blood for 30 minutes in humans, would vary with temperament, age, and so forth. But in nearly any case, all the blood in the body can be drained away in about half an hour. All Harvey is really saying is that Harvey's figure may not be accurate, at least the blood flow cannot go below a certain minimum, which in turn is considerably above a certain other figure, the maximum that blood would have to be converted in the intake of food. This is not at all against Aristotle's view of mathematics, which allows that geometric and arithmetic reasoning is hypothetically necessary. What both Aristotle and Harvey would object to is the insistence that because mathematical formulas, concepts, and certain cases, they are somehow causative of the effect in an essential way. Number is a causal, not a determinant. The mathematical method can only prove certain cases of one kind of thing, but not the two things are essentially alike. All we prefer, applied mathematics does not give you the what or derived equations and proportions in the what, but only in general statements that certain connections hold the human properties of this. We cannot discuss here the symmetry of diameter of vessels leaving the ventricles, the position of valves in the heart and veins, and so forth. All the chief arguments in the third portion of the motion of the heart are in terms of shape, size, and movement, not of purposes, or such clinical functions as the concussion of blood or skin. But it is part of Harvey's achievement to be able to make clear these two. And certainly, he made the new results of those mechanical ones just described. So, my third example intertwined with the two arguments relates to the general notion of purposes of heart and blood. Harvey is dealing with a living body. Nutrition, sensation, emotion, and other capacities are instinct in it, along with the heart, which regularly impels the blood, as it were, in its system. In short, Harvey following Aristotle was considered the final causes of the heart to rest into the blood, as well as their material causes and the efficient causes of their structure and motion. The last three chapters of the motion of the heart show the several parts in their physiological relations to each other and to their body as an organic whole. The efficient and material cause by themselves would give us give us a mere hydraulic system, inconsequentially related to the living body. These two factors, again, are labeled a posteriori, that is, the beginning is no effect and can be the cause. Other lower teleology seems to represent a supporting evidence after the high arguing zones have all been mechanically interpreted in relation to each other and to the motions of the blood they contain. In the same way, Aristotle distinguished between what he called biological necessity and biological reason, the latter working to a definite end, the former not. Both, he thought, were necessary, though in varying proportions to explain that. Some have wondered why Harvey never called the heart a pump, and it has to speak of what he must really have meant. I submit, on the other hand, that he became fully aware of the methodological implications of Aristotle's metaphysical causes, seeing the need of an account fully commensurate with the nature of the past in motions described. He was hardly so naive as to think of the heart always as a mere efficient cause, though it is always an impeller as well. He was more subtle against the assert that the heat is always the final cause of both cause and whole in the body. He would have considered the description of fistula and diastole as always respectively active and passive, with strong need of reservation. But these involutions in his dialectic are not, as historians have sometimes thought, the result of hasty compilation, lost notes, or the like. Aristotelian causes are ascribed to specific parts of the body with respect to certain other specific parts or functions. They are not laid down dogmatically for an entire subject matter. But however, the animal digests food, drinks blood in the digestive tract, and then the heart perceives and reports it to the rest of the body. The blood is part of the body, nourishes and is nourished, and is both efficient cause and material cause with respect to these nutritive functions, but not to the motor functions. Harvey says that the heart returns into lost in the blood of the extremity. The human heart is the prime cause of instrument of every function in the living people. He says, the blood, instead of receiving, rather gives heat to the heart which addresses all other parts of the body, for the blood is the hottest element in the body. For this reason, is the heart remarkable for its quality to be viewed as the laboratory fountain and perennial focus of heat, and is comparable to a hot kettle, not because of its fatty substance, but because of its continuous blood. So blood is the material cause of the heat of the body. The blood is that which is hot for the heart, and the heart is the formal cause of the heat, not the heating agent, but the structural position of heating. The heart gives movement to the blood, hence is the efficient cause, not of the blood itself, or its heat, but of its motion. Here then are three abbreviated examples of highly complex methods, using Aristotle's logical proof and his great philosophy of interrelated causes. In them, it is seen that we should not interpret Harvey as a repeater of the structural concepts of Aristotle's system, merely elaborating upon them and then putting it in the alleged observations into them. If, on the other hand, we think of Harvey as making use of the concepts in heuristic fashion, then, finding a reasonable picture in this preliminary dialectical examination of possibilities and authorities, making some of these possibilities physical for demonstrating the circuit of the blood, then this methodological reading is obviously related to Aristotle's mission. This kind of use would explain how the singular combination of blood and liver. From Aristotle's theory of induction and the intuitive grasp of first principles, Harvey realized that even if the formal conditions of syllogism are inherited, that the inquiry is not restricted to time, which by their inspection can give strict reference to the terms chosen, then the result would be least terminology through the factors too. the first conclusion is from one subject matter and conclusions about facts and premises about facts, and conclusions about blood and premises about divine spirit. However, not to have in some way an accessory render account of blood spirit. Connection outside of unique subject matter is pulling together, not necessary. The Malayan Tiger has adhered admirably to a method meeting the requirements of the Aristotelian plan. This in itself is not making a great man. But it may be that he grasps not only the importance of the concept of quantity and motion, as he saw in the long agreed, but also that the quality and form, longer lived, of fundamental categories. In so many technical observation categories, he is able, moving from very sophisticated means of reasoning, together with a large variety of manual procedures, to devise this conspicuous demonstration. And the demonstration has, in its large outline, and nearly all its materials, given to one or two prerogatives in the past section, been understood and accepted even by those lacking close acquaintance with the theoretical presuppositions upon which Tiger rested. I would better to say that the originality and soundness of the view are not wholly incompatible with the use of concepts and methods derived from a tradition long held in disrepute for its current theory and sovereignty. The later history of medicine, however much it embraced Tiger's anatomical findings, would have done worse than to continue to learn more from the happy employment that he made of the society.